Welcome to the 8th Congressional District Candidate Forum. My name is Beth English. I'm the Voter Service Chairperson of the Appleton League of Women Voters. Tonight, you will have the opportunity to meet Democratic candidate Congressman Steve Kagan and the Republican challenger, Mr. Reed Ribble, running for U.S. House of Representatives, 8th District. Nonpartisan organizations sponsoring tonight's forum are AAUW, Appleton League of Women Voters, Appleton Public Library, the Coalition of Wisconsin Aging Groups, ESTER, Fox City's Rotary Multicultural Center, Midday Women's Alliance, Project Promise, the Post Crescent, Wisconsin Alliance for Retired Americans, WHBY Radio, WBAY TV2, and the University of Wisconsin Fox Valley. This forum was made possible through the generous donation of time and talent by those organizations. We thank Autumn Hill Creative for our brochures and posters, and we also thank Fox Valley Lutheran High School for allowing us to use their wonderful facility. At this time, I'd like to introduce Mr. Robert Becker. He's the business manager for Fox Valley Lutheran High School. Thank you.
Thank you, Beth, and we'd like to welcome everybody to Fox Valley Lutheran High School this evening. As I look around the room, I see a lot of familiar faces. I see a lot of our students are here tonight, but I also see a lot of faces that I don't recognize. It might be your first time visiting our campus, so we welcome you to our campus. Each day, the students, faculty, and staff of our school get to meet in this room for about 20 minutes. And have our daily devotion and take care of other announcements and so on. So we welcome you to our auditorium and hope that you'll have a chance to come back and visit us again. We look forward to a very good evening of candidates presenting their positions, and hopefully they will do a very good job for us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Becker. Questions for the candidates have been compiled by the community sponsors of this forum and from readers and listeners of the Post Crescent and WHBY Radio. Questions will be asked by our panelists, Mr. Dan Flannery, Executive Director, Executive Editor of the Post Crescent, Mr. Mike Kemeter, News Director of HBY Radio, and Shirley Strange, President of the Appleton League of Women Voters. We are enthused to have both candidates here to address the important issues that concern the citizens of this district. In the interest of time and courtesy to our candidates, we ask that you refrain from applause or in other ways indicating support or non-support for a candidate. Promptly at 7 p.m., we'll begin our live broadcast. Thanks again to WBAY TV2. There will be no commercial interruptions this evening, and the broadcast will conclude just before 8 p.m. There will be a brief closing, and then we invite you to stay and greet the candidates in the lobby. It's almost time to start now, so I'd like to introduce our moderator for this evening's Candidates Forum. Our moderator is Cammie Rapson, WBAY TV2 News Anchor. Cammie's reports have earned more than a dozen awards from the Wisconsin Broadcasting Association, Associated Press, including Best Series Reporting 2 years in a row, the Milwaukee Press Club. She was also part of the Action 2 News team that won a prestigious Edward R. Murrow National Award. Please help me welcome Ms. Cammie Rapson. And now we'd like to start out with the Pledge of Allegiance to unite us in our common purpose this evening. Would you all rise for the Pledge of Allegiance? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. Thank you. Good.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this evening's forum for Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District. The 8th District covers much of Northeast Wisconsin. The purpose of this forum tonight is to hear from both candidates about issues important to the district. Some of you submitted topics of interest online for consideration tonight, and we thank you for that. We especially wish to thank Fox Valley Lutheran High School for hosting this event tonight. We also want to thank the candidates for appearing this evening, of course, Democratic Congressman Steve Kagan, and Republican candidate Mr. Reed Ribble. Questions will be asked by our panelists. We have three of them tonight. Dan Flannery, executive editor of the Post Crescent. Mike Kemeter, news director of WHBY 1150 Radio. And Shirley Strange, president of the Appleton League of Women Voters. This is how it will work. We will begin this evening with opening statements. Both candidates will be allowed 2 minutes for an opening statement. Then we will begin with the first question. The candidate will be allowed 2 minutes for a response. Each question will have a follow-up question that will be allowed a one-minute response. The other candidate will then be asked the same two-minute question and a one-minute general follow-up question. Then each candidate will be allowed 30 seconds for final thoughts on each topic. At the end of the evening, each candidate will have 1 minute for closing remarks. This format has been agreed to by both candidates, the League of Women Voters, and our co-sponsors tonight. We do have timekeepers in place. Time limits will be strictly enforced, just so you know. We do have a live audience tonight. We thank you for being here. There are house rules, though, folks. No campaign signs or campaign literature allowed in the theater. Cell phones, pagers, and any recording devices are to be turned off. Unauthorized videos or sound recordings not allowed tonight. Please refrain from applause, signs of displeasure, or other distractions. Please allow us the time to get all of the questions answered in tonight's program. My name is Cammie Rapson. I'm from WBAY-TV2, and I'm serving as your moderator for tonight. A coin toss offstage determined which candidate would be starting this evening, and we will start with opening remarks from Mr. Reed Ribble.
Thank you very much, Cammie. Thank you to the panel, and thank you, Congressman, for joining us this evening. Thanks to the audience that decided to come out on a windy fall night in Wisconsin. It's been a privilege of mine to be a candidate for this position. I joined the race about a year ago, as many of you know, out of concern for my family. I was challenged last Christmas, actually Christmas of 2009, by my son, 2008, by my son, saying, "Dad, you always taught me that if I didn't like my circumstance in life, that I ought to go change it." And as I was complaining about the state of the economy, reckless spending in Washington, D.C., an ever-expanding government that encroaches on our liberty, I decided that I would go ahead and take that challenge. I was disappointed with where government was. I didn't like the station in life. I was concerned for my grandchildren. I have two of them. They're 5 and 7. And I'm very concerned about the future for them. What is the legacy of this generation of Americans? My father was a U.S. Marine in World War II. He passed away in 2002. And Tom Brokaw wrote a wonderful book about that generation, calling them the greatest generation. I wonder what a historian will say in 20 years from now about this generation of Americans that sat idly by as our government spent their future away. $13.2 trillion of national debt will be passed on to our children and grandchildren unless there's a change. I got in this race because I'm concerned for them. I got in this race because I want a better legacy for my generation, and I look very much forward to this evening and talking about these topics. Thank you very much to the League of Women Voters for having me, and I will look forward to talking with you tonight.
Mr. Ribble, thank you very much. Congressman Steve Kagan, your opening remarks tonight.
Well, thank you, Cammie, and thank you to everyone for putting on this event. It's very necessary that everyone have available all the facts of where people stand on the issues. I deeply appreciate this opportunity to be with you. 4 years ago, I did something for the first time in my life. I ran for public office as a small business owner and as a physician. I ran for office because our children were being sent off to war, because our jobs were being sent overseas, and because my patients did not have access to the care they needed just to survive. And now, as your representative, I'm working hard to clean up the biggest economic mess of our nation's history. I voted no to bailouts and yes to jobs. And remember this, I didn't start this fire, but I'm working hard to put it out. I fought hard to bring a new VA hospital to Green Bay to better serve our veterans. I pushed back against China when they were dumping paper into our domestic marketplace illegally, taking away our paper industry. I've helped to save thousands of jobs in the paper industry by doing so. But there is much more work to do. People everywhere are still hurting. People need our help. But my opponent and I disagree on many of the issues. Reid says he's concerned about the debt, but he's already pledged to give tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires, which would add $700 billion more to our debt. That's not being fiscally responsible. It's certainly not being conservative fiscally. I'm protecting Social Security. My opponent has said he needs to phase it out. But this election really isn't about me, and it's not about Reid. It's really about the people in Northeast Wisconsin having someone who's on their side, someone who's already stood up to Wall Street, big banks, big oil, and big insurance companies. We're going to make it in America. When we stop pointing fingers and start joining hands, amazing things are going to happen. Today, I'm humbly and respectfully asking for your vote. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Congressman Kagan. We will begin tonight with our first panelist, Dan Flannery from the Post Crescent. He will be addressing this first question to Mr. Reid Ribble.
Thank you. Good evening to both of you, and thanks for participating. Let's start with your thoughts on job creation. The most recent numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics show that Wisconsin's unemployment rate is 7.8%. National unemployment is around 9.6%. That's about twice the levels of 2006-2007. At the same time, the Bureau says that across the country there are about 1.2 million discouraged workers who no longer believe jobs are available for them and aren't looking for work. So clearly, job creation is on the top of every candidate's to-do list, but even some employed workers struggle to make ends meet because of wage concessions or other higher benefit costs. In 2 minutes, share some of your ideas, not your opponent's ideas, for creating good-paying jobs that will allow families to earn a living wage in order to be self-supporting.
Thank you for that question. That should be fairly easy because the Congress hasn't been the Congress has been neglect of ideas. Ideas have been absent in the Congress for creating jobs. This is the number one issue, Dan, and I'm really glad that you asked it. The government doesn't create jobs except those jobs that are in the public sector. They're particularly adept at creating government jobs and particularly inept at creating private sector jobs. But what the government is very, very good at is they are good at putting obstacles in the way of real job creation. And we need to look at what those obstacles are. The first one is a lack of clarity. There's no clarity coming out of the White House, no clarity coming out of the U.S. House of Representatives, no clarity coming out of the Senate about what the future should look like in this country. Without clarity, there can be no certainty. And so business owners are afraid to hire. I've had hundreds of business owners in the last year tell me, you know what, I think I'll just add some overtime right now instead. And so what the government needs to do is begin to remove those obstacles, whether it's in poorly managed tax law or oppressive regulations that have caused the problem that we're in. We need to remove the uncertainty. Bills that are partially passed, partially proposed, that will continue to restrict and discourage job creation in Wisconsin.
My follow-up question, Mr. Ribble. As I recall, both of you are in some agreement that helping small business grow is the key to job growth overall. But there are differences in how that help should come. And I think specifically on trade policy, you differ. As I recall, you believe corporate taxes should be lowered and that businesses endure too much regulation. To that latter point on regulation, how much regulation is appropriate to provide the proper protections and oversight but not hurt business?
Well, I think that 78,000 pages of regulations per year is too much. It's clearly too much because we see the result. Nearly 15 million Americans unemployed. What I've been proposing is a 24-month moratorium on future regulations. Let's just put a stop to it for 24 months so that we can send some clarity and certainty to those small business owners. Let them know that the government, rather than declaring war on them, and those are the words I heard from a manufacturer in Sturgeon Bay just a few weeks ago, that the government has declared war on them. That's a tragedy that a business owner would say that. Let's give them 24 months to breathe some clean air and go about creating jobs. That's what I would recommend.
Congressman Kagan, the initial question for you again is, you know, share some of your ideas, not Mr. Ribble's, on creating good-paying jobs that allow families to earn a living wage to be self-supporting.
Well, thank you very much for the question of our generation. But never forget how we fell into this economic recession. How did we get here? We had policies where there were two tax cuts to the wealthy without paying for it. We had two wars at the same time, didn't pay a dime for that either. We had a handout of $400 billion to Big Pharma, didn't pay for that either. And then at the tail end of the last administration, they cracked open the door to the Treasury and allowed their friends in Wall Street, and Goldman Sachs and others, to take out nearly $1 trillion and didn't pay for that either. So we have a great deal of debt that has accumulated. We lost during the last administration a net of 433,000 jobs. During President Clinton's time, he had generated 22 million jobs. We're at the point today where the wealthiest 1% of our economy, those people own 83% of the stock on Wall Street, and 63% of households are struggling just to make it. They're living paycheck to paycheck. So never forget how we got in there. It was tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires, deregulation of Wall Street, and on top of that, tax loopholes that allowed our corporations on Wall Street to take our jobs and ship them to China and elsewhere. So we can't repeat the mistakes of the past. So everyone is angry, like I am, like Reed is, like everybody here and everyone watching, because everyone on Main Street today is being asked to pay for the mistakes of the speculators and gamblers on Wall Street who crashed our economy. So we can't have too much. We need effective regulation. We need to make sure that small business has access to the credit they need to grow our economy. 93% of all employers are small business. But today, the credit markets are frozen, so we need access to credit. We can't repeat those policies. In the House of Representatives, I helped to pass legislation to reinstate pay-as-we-go. Pay-as-we-go means we can't put any bill forward that isn't paid for, either by raising revenue or cutting other programs. It worked during President Clinton's time. It'll work over time, once again, to balance our budget.
The follow-up question for you, Mr. Congressman Kagan, is, again, on trade agreements. As I recall, you favor balanced trade agreements. And you say if we can produce goods in America, then we should be able to buy the goods that we produce in America. Won't that raise costs for consumers, and aren't there issues inherent with that?
Well, costs are going up now in any case. We've got some mild inflation. But look at what we already have done. The Hire Act, it used to be called the Hiring Act that I had written, it became the Hire Act. And it provided for businesses a tax credit for hiring somebody who's been out of work. This is what we call lowering the cost of labor to make sure that the cost, the overhead costs, go down for business. We also voted to close tax loopholes that these corporations have been using to ship our jobs overseas. Yes, we need balanced trade. I put forward a bill that would guarantee that if you want to sell paper in our domestic market, then you should manufacture it with good manufacturing practices, including taking our clean air and clean water standards. China can't compete with us unless they manipulate the currency value, unless they continue to provide subsidies illegally outside of our trade laws. So we have to push back against China with their unbalanced and unfair advantages. And that's what I'm working so hard to do.
Mr. Ribble, your final thoughts on this topic.
Yeah, I think you have to compare, if we're going to look at the Clinton administration and Bush administration, it was the last 2 years during a Pelosi-Kagan Congress that we lost the jobs. And it was in the Clinton years with the Republican-held Congress that we created those jobs. And there are key philosophical differences in regard to that. And it was lower regulations. As far as the freezing up of credit, that is a regulatory problem. And that's part of the reason that small businesses aren't creating jobs.
Congressman Kagan, your final thoughts?
Yes, well, if we pay as we go, we're going to live within our means in Washington the same way we do around our kitchen tables each and every month when we pay our bills. More importantly, I put forward an amendment that passed unanimously in the House of Representatives that would allow small banks, not Wall Street, but small banks, to spread out their potential losses over time and keep loans functional, keep them active, don't call them in. Access to credit. We have a cash, a credit, and a confidence crisis right now in our country, and it's small banks and small business that will lead us forward.
Thank you both. And now we go on to our second panelist, Shirley Strange. She is here tonight with the League of Women Voters. And your question to Congressman Kagan.
Congressman Kagan. With the debt at $13.2 trillion and the deficit at $1.4 trillion, would you deal with the debt and deficit issues through increasing government revenue or decreasing government spending? Please give some specifics with your answer.
Sure, and thank you for the question, because our national debt is a crisis. It has brought many other nations to their knees. But today, jobs trump debt. If people have a job and they're working, they can stay in their own home, they can pay their own bills, and we can begin to resolve and find the floor in the housing crisis market. Without finding a floor in our housing industry, we won't be able to work our way back into prosperity. So first and foremost, we have to focus on jobs, because today, jobs trump debt. So I have just indicated to you that I co-sponsored legislation to pay as we go, to live within our means. I also agree with the president's idea about freezing the discretionary spending for a period of years until such time as we can begin to see a balanced budget coming forward. So we have to do some belt tightening in Washington. Everyone agrees that we can't spend our way into prosperity. But at the same time, we have to help people who need help the most. And that's going to be the middle class. So I'm going to be voting to extend the middle class tax cuts and to guarantee that they have an opportunity to stay in their own home. We have to solve our housing crisis simultaneously while we help people to get back employed.
And the follow-up question, I think you've answered part of this, but to stop spending, we must make cuts. Where would you make them? To increase revenues, we must raise taxes. What taxes would you propose?
Well, I've also been working with Secretary Gates. When he gave his speech about his intent to find and eliminate all wasteful spending within the military budget, the Department of Defense, I applauded him, I communicated with him, and asked him for a list of specific cuts he was looking to make. And he found $330 billion of projects that would not enhance our national security. Things like our missile shield, things like the F-22, and others. I also encouraged him to continue to invest in our LCS ships and bring them back to our state. So there are ways we can eliminate wasteful spending, particularly in health care. It's not my view, but it's the view of of other experts, that there's nearly $1 trillion of wasteful spending within our health care industry. We can provide access to the highest quality care at a lower price by rooting out and eliminating the wasteful spending within it. So, yes, I'm in favor of tightening the belt in our federal budget. I'm very much in favor of tightening the Department of Defense and making sure that we find out where all the wasteful spending is in healthcare as well.
And Mr. Ribble, the main question, with the debt at $13.2 trillion, the deficit at $1.4 trillion, would you deal with the debt and deficit issues through increasing government revenue or decreasing government spending? And please give us some specifics.
Sure. You have to deal with them both ways. You have to increase revenue. You have to decrease spending. I have to chuckle a little bit at PAYGO. This comes around just about every election cycle. If we had real PAYGO, if we were paying as we go, you couldn't have a $1.3 trillion deficit spending. Otherwise, you're not paying as you go. The pay is going away is what's happening. The reality is that instead of raising up taxes, what we ought to be doing is focusing on raising up taxpayers. If we can put 15 million Americans back to work, if we can get 8 million Americans that are underemployed to full employment, you bring the revenue into the Treasury. So you keep taxes low to encourage job creation. And I mean, we hear from Congress some ideas about providing small businesses some tax relief, and all that tax relief is needed. And so we can do that by raising up and creating more jobs. That's how you fix it on the revenue side. On the deficit side, you get out of debt at government level and a business level and a personal level the same way you get in, incrementally over time. And our Congress has incrementally over the last 50 years continued to expand itself and continued to grow government. A reduction for a federal legislator is a reduction in growth. You know, let's cut the rate of spending in half and call it a cut. Well, what we need is some structural cuts specifically in the budget. And we can start across the board. We can start by reducing duplication of services that are being done by states. There's plenty of places to look.
I really think you've answered the follow-up we must make cuts to stop spending. And where might we make them? to increase revenues, we must raise taxes. What taxes would you propose?
I don't think in a recession that you raise any taxes. I think that's a huge mistake. It's anti-job, anti-business, anti-American at this point. We need to keep our taxes low. I mean, stop and think about it. If the idea is that, whatever, $700 billion or $1 trillion of stimulus is going to stimulate the economy, if taking money from the government and giving it to somebody is going to stimulate the economy, let's let them keep that money in the first place so that they can stimulate the local economy and their families and their households. And that way, they begin to consume and have confidence in what's going out of their pocket. That's how you do it. You don't have to raise up taxes to increase the flow or velocity of money in our economy.
Congressman Kagan, your final thoughts on this?
Well, we need to make things here in America because manufacturing actually matters. When you make things, you actually have things. And these are the higher wage jobs that we need in the middle class to sustain ourselves, to not just educate ourselves, but also to educate our families. We need to have balanced trade with China. China must bring an end to their manipulation of their currency. I voted to close the tax loopholes that sent our jobs to China. I voted to push back on China and force them to stop manipulating their currency. And I pushed back against China to save our paper jobs. So it's not an idea. I've already done it.
Mr. Ribble, your final thoughts.
Yeah, we really want to get to jobs right here in North Wisconsin. Maybe we could start with our timber industry. We're one of the most timber-rich districts in the United States, and yet here we are in Wisconsin importing lumber from Canada, and it goes back to mismanaged forest lands and bad regulation, and we're losing hundreds and hundreds of timber jobs.
Now, Mike Hemeter, please address your next question to Mr. Reed Ribble.
Mr. Ribble, federal lawmakers created a new health care reform law earlier this year. What positive steps does it take, and what could be improved or changed?
Yeah. The health care bill is a problem for me, and it's a problem for almost every single small business. I was with a company just today in Shawano, and they told me that the cost of the health care bill to their company alone in 2014 is going to be $2 million. That's the additional cost that they told me today. Now, that's $40,000, $50,000 a year jobs right there. If you want to solve some of the health care crisis, let's solve the job crisis first. You know, healthy nations typically come from wealthy nations. Let's raise up the economy and let's improve the economy. Let's stop destroying jobs in this country and we'll get there. There were some good things in the health care bill that I did like, but there are lots of things that need to be improved. First of all, we could have addressed tort reform, but that's difficult to do in a Congress that is filled with attorneys, quite frankly. We need to broaden the base of the members of Congress so that we can get a more fair and balanced look at legislation. Why should the American consumer have to pay excessive liability insurance rates so that trial lawyers can get rich? What we need to do is have a provision in there where the loser pays. If a doctor damages somebody, I'm not saying a lawsuit shouldn't happen. What I'm saying is let's get rid of the frivolous lawsuit by putting a loser pay provision in. Let's incentivize doctors to do more pro bono work to serve indigent people by giving them a tax credit when they do work for free. And then let's let associations like the NFIB pool together a million of their employees nationwide and buy cross state lines in small association pools and plants, not just in the state of Wisconsin, but throughout the U.S., so we can increase the size of the risk pools. Those are things that would have driven costs down. Those are things that would have bent the cost curve down and improved the circumstances.
My follow-up question, Mr. Ribble, is, what would you like the health care policy to be in 2 years when this upcoming term is completed?
Yeah, I think that we need to start over, quite frankly. I think that by going at a very broad approach that they took, we've actually damaged American job creation. Business owners all over the district are telling me, I don't know what this new health care bill is going to cost me, but I know it's going to cost a lot. I'll just give someone overtime rather than creating a new job. What I believe we should have done is we should have taken that person that had a pre-existing condition, that person without insurance, and in a very micro level, work specifically toward that 10 or 15% of the population rather than saying, I'm going to force fit this bill or this program to 85% of the population as well. We could have done it in a more micro level that would have cost much less money.
Congressman Kagan? Federal lawmakers created a new health care reform law earlier this year. What positive steps does it take, and what could be improved or changed?
Well, thank you, Mike, for the question. Access to high-quality health care for my patients was the reason I got into politics. When I was taking care of Jenny, a single mom with two kids, and I wrote her a prescription, and she took the prescriptions to the pharmacy, I told her her kids were going to get better. They'd be back in school. They wouldn't be sick with their asthma. When she came back a month later, the kids were still out of control, still out of school, and still sick. And I came down pretty hard on her. I said, you know, Jenny, it's a funny thing about this medication. It only works if you put it in their mouth. And she put her bag on my counter where I sit with the patient, and she unzipped her purse and took out the same prescriptions, and she said, Dr. Kagan, I went to the pharmacy. I stood at the counter. I could see the medicine, but I couldn't afford to put it in their mouth. What can you do for me now? I said, that's it. I can't fix health care like this. I can't be a mayor, can't be a county executive. I've got to go to Washington and bring some sense to them. And that sense put patients first. We're beginning to fix what's broken, and we're improving on what we already have. We now have five new American freedoms that I'll fight my heart out against anyone to protect. You're free from discrimination against pre-existing conditions. As of 9/23, no longer can any child be discriminated against just because of the way they're born. You're free from cancellation. You've got insurance. You get sick. Days gone by, my patients were cut off just because they got ill. No longer can you be canceled when you get sick. And the biggest plus, the number one cause of bankruptcy in your district has been the cost of health care that drove families broke and out of their home. No longer, because we've eliminated the annual cap and the lifetime cap. No longer will any family have to go broke and lose their home simply because a child has an accident or gets sick. So I think there are a lot of positives that we put into this. There's a lot of Northeast Wisconsin in this law.
Congressman Kagan, the follow-up, what would you like the health care policy to be in 2 years when the upcoming term is completed?
I'm working very hard. I put together a one-page bill. It's one sentence. It's Transparency in All Health Care Pricing Act. It says that any individual or business that offers health care products or services for sale to the public must at all times openly disclose all of the prices they've taken as payment in full. I'm looking forward to Reid supporting me in this. I have Joe Barton, who's the ranking Republican member of the Energy and Commerce Committee, going to be working with me when I get back to Washington with your help. We need transparency to drive quality up and prices down. Transparency not just in price, but in quality, in outcomes, and in service. Patients want to go shopping. I think the exchange isn't going to be any government exchange. I think it's going to be the Internet. I'd like you to be able to take your smartphone, type in the medication you need, and then you've got a map of where you can buy that medication, and you'll know the price of a pill before you swallow it.
Mr. Ribble, final thoughts?
Congressman, in January, I'll be happy to take your transparency bill forward. And but I will tell you, I agree that we can service the indigent patient, the patient that doesn't have care. We can find ways to do that. But I want the American people to know there's a reckoning coming, that every single time the federal government has created a large entitlement program, they have underestimated and have confused the American people on what the real costs are going to be. And I am hearing from business owners around the district that the cost of this is going to be very high, and they're going to begin to drop insurance.
Congressman Kagan, your final thoughts.
First and foremost, this is not a government takeover. It's private doctors, private clinics, private insurance, and patients making up their own mind. They've got the freedom now. Patients get to choose their doctor. It's not a government takeover. And if you're in small business, wake up. There's money on the table for you. If you're a small business owner with 24 or fewer employees, there's up to 35% tax credit coming back into your pocket this year already because of this new law. If you're a senior citizen, prevention. We're focusing on prevention. Mammograms, preventive services, no deductibles, no co-payments. That's what we've succeeded in achieving.
Dan Flannery, now your question to Congressman Kagan.
Let's move to another key topic for a lot of voters in this district, Social Security. According to reports prepared for the Social Security Administration itself, funds for Social Security will be exhausted somewhere around 2037 to 2041. This solvency issue is not a new one, and a raft of proposals for saving or extending Social Security benefits have been debated for years. Where are you on this issue? In your opinion, and please don't speak for Mr. Ribble's view, what needs to be done to keep Social Security solvent for future generations, and what steps do you believe are necessary?
Well, thank you, Dan, for the question on Social Security. On this subject, there's a very clear distinction. We're very far apart about our views about Social Security. My record, you'll always know where I stand on Social Security. I have always said I will protect Social Security against anyone who would seek to privatize it, personalize it, or otherwise phase it out. Social Security is a sacred trust between one generation and the next. It is a winning Wisconsin idea right here from Madison. It's the greatest anti-poverty program any government has ever created in human history. So it's sound until 2037, at which time 78% of your benefits would be available to you. So if we have to adjust anything, it would be the cap on income applicable to the Social Security tax. And if Warren Buffett is willing to pay the same tax rate as his secretary, I don't see any reason why the rest of us can't concede to do that as well. There's nothing wrong at all with everybody joining together and understanding that we're really all in this together. You are your brother's keeper. You are here in a community. And without Social Security, about 140,000 people, your neighbors, may not make it. Earlier today, I had a town hall, and a woman who was just making it on Social Security wondered why there wasn't a cost of living increase. Well, with the devaluation of everything because of the Wall Street financial collapse, the formula said there's no increase. So I put forward two pieces of legislation to help her and everyone else that's on a fixed income. What did I do? I co-sponsored legislation that would guarantee $250 immediately to help her get through the next several months, and also to eliminate any income tax on someone 65 years of age and older with an income annually of below $50,000. So on this subject of Social Security, there's a clear contrast between my opponent and myself.
The follow-up question, you mentioned raising the income cap. That's one of the issues, one of the fixes that's been talked about, raising the income cap, raising the retirement age, doing means testing for the benefits. How many of those are long-term solutions, and how many of them are Band-Aids that get us through a shorter period?
Let me tell you what I won't do. I will not vote to cut benefits. I will not vote to increase the age at which you can retire to claim the benefits that you've already worked so hard to earn. I will not do those things. But part of fixing Social Security is fixing our economy and making sure we have more people at work paying taxes that will pay it forward. That's the whole concept of Social Security. But on this subject, we're clearly different. When Reid was interviewed on a radio channel, Voice of Liberty, he said these words, Social Security, quote, this is about patronage. This was about buying votes. It was never intended to be a legitimate program ever, close quotes. So on Social Security, Reid and I have a vastly different point of view about Social Security. I'll fight hard to protect it. Reid has said we're going to phase it out.
Mr. Ribble, I'll rephrase the initial question. we've got a system that's about ready to expire in 2037 or thereabouts. What needs to be done to make it solvent for future generations?
Sure. I love it when politicians who've been in office for 4 years and haven't done anything about it talk about what they're going to do. So here's the reality. There's been about $1 million smear campaign run on television. Good night. My wife is a grandmother. I want her to get her Social Security, but she's not even convinced she's going to get it. It's really been something. It's been almost surreal. I have said from the very beginning that when I got in this race that we have made promises. We, the American people, have made promises to our seniors and those near retirement, and we have to keep those promises. But I also said that I've got a 4-year-old grandson, and we need to keep a promise to him as well. And we've got a problem in this country because the fact of the matter is we can deny demographics. We cannot deny that we've got an aging workforce. We can deny that we've got a birth rate that's just at replacement level. We can deny that there won't be enough workers for my 4-year-old grandson when he gets to be 65. And then just let them take the 25% hit. Or we can today stop demagoguing it. We can stop politicizing it. We can stop using senior scare tactics. We can stop manipulating politics. And we can get busy, but it's going to take grown-ups. It's going to take people that will stop threatening seniors, It's going to take people to stop manipulating things and lying about things. It's going to take real grown-ups. We need to put them in a room and say our objectives are simple. We're going to work and protect our seniors, and we're going to find a solution for our children. Now, let's come together and develop that plan so that both seniors and children, this generation and that generation and the next generation, have a Social Security system that's secure for them, that recognizes those other things like changing demographics. And that is what I've been advocating from the very beginning. It's been a distortion about my position in Social Security. I have never once said that we should take Social Security away from any senior. Never once.
So let me ask that follow-up question again. Many of the fixes that have been talked about, raising the income cap, retirement age, means testing, things like that, how many of those are really good long-term fixes? How many of those are just Band-Aids?
Sure. Well, I think that raising the cap on the wage of where you pay. Social Security is a relatively regressive tax because it stops at $106,000. And so when Citigroup gave away their $100 million of bonuses, there were no Social Security taxes paid on that money. And so that's certainly one of the fixes that has to be on the table. I'm concerned about raising the retirement age, although that may be something that you look at over time as medicine is improved, as Americans are living healthier lives longer. You may want to consider that. In fact, the Congress did that when Ronald Reagan was president. They considered it and actually implemented a two-year increase. I go back to what I said at the beginning. What we need to do is we need to look at all of these options to create a long-term solution that works for our seniors and my grandson.
Congressman Kagan, final thoughts?
Well, I didn't hear an answer to the question about how he's going to fix it, but he did say during a Fox Valley Initiative candidate forum that, quote, somehow we have to establish a phase out of the current Social Security system to a new system. That will have to happen over time. It could happen in a single generation. And he finished with these words, it will probably require a fair amount of change in the retirement age, close quotes. So his position today is different than it was back then. He was seriously considering increasing the age at which you could claim your benefits.
Mr. Ribble, final thoughts.
Yeah, and just as a point of order, I have a single notepad here, which is what the rules were. A two-term congressman still has crib notes. It wasn't allowed. But I will say this, that I have been very specific on how and when and the ideas that we should use to change the Social Security system so that it will work for all Americans, young and old.
Now let's move to Shirley Strange. She will be asking the next question to Mr. Reed Ribble.
Mr. Ribble, Medicare. Medicare trustees have warned that the trust's assets are likely to be exhausted by 2019. After 2019, monthly Medicare taxes will cover only 79% of Part A's benefits and progressively less over time. What does Congress have to do to make Medicare Part A financially sound over the long run?
Yeah. Medicare is a real problem. And in fact, it was the driving force, I believe, on why health care reform needed to happen. The numbers simply don't work. And if we look at the unfunded liability for Medicare, it's currently at $74 trillion. This is an enormous number. In fact, the total net worth of the American people, their real estate and businesses, is only $72 trillion. So we've got a mathematics problem. The system cannot sustain itself, and the rate of growth cannot continue to be there, or it can't be done. And so things have to change. And some things that could be done that I felt, and this is what I felt we missed out on the health care reform, was really getting to a place where we started to target in and focus in on health outcomes earlier in the process. One of the things I liked about the health care bill was the fact that parents could have children in their program or in their family plan a little bit longer, because then we can get those young adults into the system sooner, which would help as you start to build a history with their family practice physicians and wellness programs. The other things that we could do is begin to encourage businesses to have wellness programs, health fitness programs within their companies, so that we can get to a better health outcome during those years that we're working. If we can get to a healthier class of senior citizen, we can begin to get costs down a bit. And that's one of the things that we can talk about.
And the follow-up, would you be willing to support the solvency of Medicare with any of the following measures? Pay a premium for Medicare Part A benefits, pay higher co-payments, and or increase the Medicare payroll tax. If not, what are your solutions?
Yeah, I think at some point prior to 2019, some of those are going to have to be looked at, including the Medicare tax. You're going to have to take a look at the numbers simply don't work. You're going to go upside down. And so, but if we could get at some of these other things that would actually drive the cost of healthcare down, like tort reform, what I talked about earlier, if we could get that into there. The experts have told me 8 to 11% savings there. If we could let large organizations pool large risk pools together, buy across state lines, we could drive costs down there. And then the cost on Medicare would also be reduced. And so it's not either or. It might be a both and it might be a combination of many things. And in fact, medicine and science itself might come up with some solutions along the way as well at the rate that it's improving.
Thank you. Congressman Kagan, Medicare trustees have warned that the trust's assets are likely to be exhausted by 2019. After 2019, monthly Medicare taxes will cover only 79% of Part A's benefits and progressively less over time. What does Congress have to do to make Medicare Part A financially sound over the long run?
Well, within the new health care law, we have instituted some measures to begin to do that. A number of efforts have been made, first to do an Institute of Medicine study looking at regional and geographic payment differences. You may not be aware, and the listeners may not be aware, but the doctors and the hospitals here in Northeast Wisconsin provide some of the highest quality care anywhere in the country. We have some of the best experts anywhere you can find. And yet, Medicare will pay those physicians and those hospitals significantly less than they pay down in Florida or Texas or other states. So we have to fix the geographical disparity. I pushed very hard to get that into our new law, and you'll see in our district about $65 million more dollars from Medicare coming in to help our hospitals, which need help the most, because today, whether you like it or not, they're providing services to Medicare patients and Medicaid below where they can make a profit. So if Medicare is paying below the overhead, that cost shifts to everybody else. So the other thing to do is to make sure that we understand where the expense is going to balloon. The largest entitlement program ever created by our government was Medicare Part D. It hasn't been paid for. So we have to have the right to negotiate for lower drug prices, for prescription drugs, putting large risk pools together, putting a purchasing pool together, and compel the drug companies, who are opposed to my election if you've been watching it on television, make the drug companies compete. Let them openly disclose their prices. Let's put our purchasing pools together to drive prices down. But the most effective way of eliminating some of the cost in Medicare is to root out and eliminate all the wasteful spending. I'll give you just a little example. $425 is what they'll pay for Medicare, what we the people pay for an outpatient cardiac scan. The same test, the same procedure in a hospital, $1,200. So how much do you want to pay, $400 or $1,200?
Okay, the follow-up is, would you be willing to support the solvency of Medicare with any of these measures? Pay a premium for Medicare Part A benefits, pay higher co-payments, or increase the Medicare payroll tax?
Well, I'm convinced we can find nearly $1 trillion of waste within the Medicare system, so you don't have to go to those extremes to mean test it, to make people pay more. When you add a co-payment to a service, a diagnostic test, people don't come in. They push back. But the most cost-effective way of moving forward is what we already have in the law, and that is to look at the cost-effectiveness studies, the outcome studies, so we're not going to be paying for things that simply don't work.
Thank you. Mr. Ribble, final thoughts on this topic?
Sure. My entire adult life, I have heard the talk from Washington about getting rid of waste, both in federal spending and in Medicare. It's been going on forever. President Obama said there are $500 billion of waste in Medicare, and yet here we are 2 years later still talking about waste. And waste is there. We have to go get at it. And on Big Pharma, We need to look at pharmaceuticals, and maybe the idea is how can we drive pharmaceutical costs down through extending patent rights by a year or 2 years? Maybe encourage them to bring some of the manufacturing here in the U.S.
Congressman Kagan, your final thoughts.
Well, look, we can root out and eliminate the wasteful spending in Medicare. It's 44,000 pages. Reid would join me in agreeing that it's far too much regulation. But we also did something else in the new law. We're moving away from payment for the volume and the number of tests you're doing back to value. So it's the value of the outcomes of what you're doing that's going to be rewarded in our new system. That's the second Institute of Medicine study that will be initiated. So we're taking positive action to root out, eliminate all waste, fraud, and abuse within the Medicare system.
We now turn to Mike Hemeter, who will ask a question of Congressman Kagan.
Congressman Kagan, poorly educated students or high dropout rates in one geographic region of the country can be a detriment to a vibrant economy for the entire nation. Please explain why you do or do not believe that the federal government should ensure that every American receives a quality education.
Well, history has proven one thing for certain. Any successful economy has been successful because they invested heavily in the education of their children and of workers who've been displaced through no fault of their own. So we have to invest heavily in the education of our children. Being a physician, I favor educating children and making certain we do that from birth until age 5. Early education matters. It begins to form the human mind, how it's going to accept new information. So we have to make sure we have educators that are talented and well compensated. We have to have a talented educator, a teacher, in every classroom. We have to cap class sizes to make sure that we don't have too many students for every teacher. I mean, it punishes people to have too many students. It's less effective than it should be. Aside from that, we have to invest fully in our educational system with federal standards. You know what's going to happen in Alabama and Mississippi if they don't have any federal regulations. What I'm opposed to is this idea of teaching to a test, like the No Child Left Behind, No Student Left Behind. I'm opposed to the idea of the federal government creating a standardized test that doesn't even measure what it's supposed to measure. So what we need now is effective investments in education. I've done something else, though. This is not an idea. This is something I've done. I've lowered the cost of higher education by $6 billion a year by passing a law and having the president sign it that would provide direct lending to students. No longer do they have to go to Wall Street banks to pay more for their higher education. So we have to lower the cost of higher education. We have to guarantee there's an educator that's talented and well compensated in every class with as few students there as possible.
And then the follow-up, Congressman Kagan. Why do you support or oppose vouchers?
I'm not totally opposed to vouchers. I don't like the idea of privatization of our school system. I went to public schools my entire lifetime. I went to Franklin Elementary School not too far from here, then to Roosevelt, then Appleton High School, then Appleton East. And from there I went on to University of Wisconsin-Madison, a public institution, then to Northwestern. So I believe in public education. I don't think we should damage it. It's really the elevator. It's what can lift children out of poverty into the middle class. So without that investment in public education, the next generation of our children doesn't stand a chance.
Mr. Ribble, again, the initial question, please explain why you do or do not believe that the federal government should ensure that every American receives a quality education.
I think that every American should receive a quality education. And I think that we're failing in providing a quality education. And in fact, the United States is ranked, I believe, at the last study I looked at, 18th in the world. We've got systemic problems in education. And yet we spend more and more money on education. So if money was just the solution, if that was the only solution that we had to offer, then we have a real problem. Because money is not the only solution. But what we could do is we could look at districts like Appleton. It's like the congressman. I went to elementary school here and junior high school here and high school here. We could look to examples like this. Just this week I met with WEAC. And had a wonderful meeting with some teachers and administrators who talked proudly and spoke proudly of what was going on in their schools. And it draws me to the point that we need to encourage education to be more local. We need to encourage education and trust our teachers that we've trained and our professionals, our administrators, our school boards and districts, our parents. We need to entrust them, because who cares more about a community, about the growth of children, about education, than the families right here in Appleton? I mean, it's a wonderful example of how education can be done correctly.
And then the follow-up, why do you support or oppose vouchers?
I do support vouchers. Here we are, Fox Valley Lutheran High School. What a wonderful private school. What a wonderful facility, paid for with private dollars. It's a prime example of what Americans can do when they come together for a common purpose, that they share their wealth, they share their generosity, and they come together to provide, in this case, a faith-based education for their children. And I think it's fine that the taxpayer, if they want to apply a voucher and use it here or to another private school, that they ought to be able to do that.
Congressman Kagan, your final thoughts?
Well, with regard to vouchers, the last thing I'd like to see is that vouchers and the creation of vouchers would bleed away funding for a public education, the only opportunity children who are in lower income situations have to make it into the middle class. And part of the problem, a huge part of the problem within our school system, is the fact that today in Appleton, nearly 60% of children in school have one or fewer parents at home. Don't expect the schools to solve all of our family problems. They're under great stress for doing so. So we have to change our ethos, change our culture about how we care about our children.
Mr. Ribble.
I'm thrilled to have grown up here. I can't think of a better place to raise a family. I can't think of a better place to educate my children. I can't think of a better place to work. I'm proud of the education system that we have here, both public and private. And we are privileged to live in this community and to live in Northeast Wisconsin.
Because we are kind of winding down for this hour, we're going to ask one more question, and each candidate will just have 2 minutes to answer it. Go ahead.
Let's get back to an employment-related question, but one that gets into the issue of immigration. Because agriculture is vital to our state's economy and farmers rely on a stable workforce, would you support legislation that would provide a legal means for farmers to hire migrant workers year-round and ensure that farm workers have basic worker rights?
I have always talked about fixing our legal immigration system. And in fact, I have a fairly extensive white paper on it at my website at ribbleforcongress.com. We have a broken legal immigration mechanism in this country. And what I've called for in the immigration system is to first secure our borders and then second, repair the legal mechanisms. And so when we look at our dairy industry, which is a $26 billion industry in Wisconsin, we need to find a way that we can have adequate supply of workers. But it can't take jobs away from American workers that want that work. And so by fixing and repairing the legal mechanism after you've secured the border, you can then, if you're nimble enough and if the system in its repair is fluid enough, in times of very high employment, we can allow more documented legal workers into the system. In times of low employment, we can draw the gates tighter closed and let fewer workers in. And it's a simple process. However, it will take a dent of will at Congress to get that working.
Congressman Kagan, the same question. Would you support legislation that would provide a legal means for farmers to hire migrant workers year-round and ensure that farm workers have basic worker rights?
I strongly believe in legal immigration. We must secure our borders, because any nation that fails to identify and defend its borders will cease to exist. We have to obey and enforce all of our laws, particularly at the site of employment, because that's why people are coming here. We need to enforce our laws of immigration at the place of employment. But here's where my opponent and I strongly disagree. What he didn't tell you about is that when he was president of the National Roofing Contractors Association, he lobbied against a bill entitled Border Protection, Anti-Terrorism, and Illegal Immigration Control Act. This was Jim Sensenbrenner, my Republican colleague. He had a good idea. And when he was president of the Roofing Contract Association, he lobbied against it. And now he's here today telling something totally different. What we have to do in agriculture, and I have the proud honor of serving on the Agriculture Committee and the Dairy and Livestock Committee, we need hardworking people. But nobody's walking down the driveway trying to milk cows three times a day. So what we have to establish is a means where we can have legal immigrants on a temporary work visa to come here. But we need a partner in Mexico. The reality is Mexico is becoming a failed state. Over 24,000 people were murdered near the border just last year. So we don't have a partner that can help us to negotiate a means whereby the government of Mexico can qualify who could be available for legal hire. Until that time, I'm going to put my foot down, and that's where it's going to stay, secure our borders, obey all of our laws, and make sure there's no amnesty, either for illegal employers or for people who are here outside the law. They must not be allowed to cut in line.
Thank you, panel, for your questions tonight. We will go now to our closing statements, and we will begin with Mr. Reid Ribble.
First of all, to the League of Women Voters, thank you so much for having us tonight. I think events like this matter in the political process. Thank you to the live audience in the auditorium this evening. Your attendance here matters in the political process. Thank you to our panelists and to congressmen for coming tonight and agreeing to have this debate. I got in this race to protect my grandchildren, and I will continue to fight hard to make sure that they receive the future that my parents and my grandparents gave to us. But our future is at risk. We've had a Congress that has continued to spend and deliberately spend our children's future and their inheritance away. The America that we're about to give them is not the America that we received from our parents. And if you would be so kind as to vote for me on November 2nd, I will go there and work tirelessly to balance our federal budget, to actually get our borders secure rather than just talking about it. And I will work hard to secure the future of not just my grandson, but yours as well. Thank you very much.
Congressman Steve Kagan, your final thoughts.
Well, thank you to everyone for attending. Thank you to everyone who's at home on television watching this very critical event. You know, it is often said during every election that this is the most important election of our time. And the difference is, this time, it's really true. And you've heard a lot of information tonight. You've got a lot to consider. And when you go to the polls next Tuesday, I'm asking you to ask yourself this question. Who's on your side? I voted no to bailouts and yes to jobs. I pushed back against communist China to save our paper jobs. I worked hard to bring back a new VA hospital to serve our veterans here in Green Bay. So I'm working hard. I'm working hard. I'm on your side. There is much more work to do. People are hurting everywhere. We have a lot to do. But by working together, I'm convinced tonight more than ever we're actually going to make it here in America. Tonight, I humbly and respectfully ask for your vote. And thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you both to Congressman Steve Kagan and Mr. Reid Ribble for being here tonight. Thank you all for being such a great audience. We appreciate it. Thanks to the candidates, the panelists, the League of Women Voters, and all the nonpartisan co-sponsors, and of course, Fox Valley Lutheran High School. We hope you have learned more about the candidates tonight, and you please will vote on Tuesday, November 2nd. Once again, if you'd like to see this forum, it will be available at WBAY.com, WHBY.com, and the PostCrescent.com as well website. Look for links on the Facebook pages of tonight's co-sponsors tonight for that as well. Thank you so much for watching. Good night.